This morning, we opened this subject of heaven. I said I wanted us to look at three key questions relating to heaven. And in opening this subject, I want us to turn back to John chapter 14. We're not staying with any one particular passage. It's just for us to get a handle on the theme that's in front of us. John chapter 14, verses 1 to 6. Our Lord Jesus Christ, prior to his death upon the cross, speaking to his disciples who are concerned about what it is about to overtake them. "Let not your heart be troubled," he said. "You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And where I go, you know, and the way you know." Thomas said to him, "Lord, we do not know where you are going, and how can we know the way?" Jesus said to him, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." This morning, then, we began to focus upon the first of these three questions. We asked, why do Christians believe in heaven? We drew attention to the fact that there are skeptics ever with us trying to pull down this conviction. Men and women who not only say there is no heaven, but who believe that it is really something akin to madness to believe in that which you cannot see. We tried to provide two basic answers to that particular question. The first was that despite the skepticism, it's not really very easy for anybody in this world to rid themselves of the conviction that some sort of afterlife exists. I tried to cite extracts from influential writers and philosophers. I even tried to draw your attention to the confusion that sometimes takes place at modern funeral services, especially where no such conviction exists. And though we said the evidence that is brought together from all these sources, and there are many others, is not conclusive, non-Christians and non-religious people find it very difficult to dismiss this conviction. And the Old Testament itself gives to us a very powerful explanation for the reason that we cannot get rid of this conviction. God has made us in such a way that we simply find it virtually impossible to respond to our existence without thought of eternity. God has made everything beautiful in its time. He has placed eternity in our hearts. But then we said that the main reason that Christians believe in the existence of an afterlife or heaven itself is the testimony of the Bible. We, as evangelical Christians, do not believe the Bible simply because we are those kind of people. You know, credulous people who will believe anything in the midst of their uncertainties and difficulties. We believe that there is good evidence for believing the testimony of the Bible to be trustworthy. It's not my interest or concern tonight to try to demonstrate that, but that is what we believe. There is good evidence for believing its testimony is trustworthy, and that the convictions of the Old Testament and New Testament writers, particularly the testimony of Jesus Christ, really does provide compelling evidence for our conviction, not only that an afterlife exists, but the heaven of which Jesus himself was most prominent in speaking. So now then we come on to this second, what I say is a key question. What will it be like to be in heaven? Some years ago, when I was pastor of a church in Kent, I remember that on a monthly basis we used to go off to a minister's fraternal. First of all, it used to take place in Maidstone, where Spurgeon, not quite in the building where Spurgeon was, but where Spurgeon used to go off for his earliest form of education, and where we used to meet, and then latterly more in the church where I was pastor. And we invited a man, it would be known to some of you, if you're really ancient like me, then you will know this name when I mention it. Harry Waite was pastor of an evangelical church in Thornton Heath, and he was invited to come and speak to the minister fraternal on the subject of heaven. The idea was that he would come in the evening, the ministers would meet in the afternoon, they would discuss pastoral matters, and then in the evening we would have someone else come and address the ministers and church officers, elders and deacons who used to come and be with us. And then someone would speak on an appointed subject, and then that subject would be open for discussion. I've never forgotten the visit of Harry Waite. I've forgotten about most of them, but I've never forgotten his addressing us that evening. His subject then was heaven, and he spoke. And he spoke entirely in terms of negatives. He was constantly telling us what heaven was not, what it did not include. And that may seem a rather sad and difficult way of approaching it, but in actual fact what it did was to leave us with a marvellous sense of what heaven would be like. By excluding all number of things, you were left with a massive accumulation of positives. But now then, tonight, I'm not going to do that. I am going to give you one negative, and I'm going to give you, I hope, two positives. So the approach is going to be slightly different. What will it be like to be in heaven? You know, that's a question, I guess, that most Christians want some sort of answer to. We think about heaven at least from time to time. We certainly read about it. It confronts us everywhere in the teaching of the Bible. And we want to be able to know what it is going to be like when we get there. And I'm going to start almost certainly by disappointing you. The reason is this. I cannot, and I don't know anyone who can upon this earth, give you a definitive answer to this particular question. And there is a simple reason for that. I have not been to heaven yet. And not having been to heaven, it is impossible for me to give a definitive answer. But our disadvantages are more than matched by the advantages that we have because of the teaching of the New Testament. You see, the Christian's position is this. We do know someone who has been to heaven. More than that, we know of someone whose eternal home was heaven, and he came into this world. And though he has not told us everything that we would like to know about heaven, he has told us sufficient that we should be glad that we are on the pathway that will finally lead to that place. You remember how John opens his gospel, and he speaks immediately and clearly and powerfully about the person of Jesus Christ. And he says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And as he develops that theme, as he draws attention to the identity of this wonderful person, he suddenly says to us, and the Word became flesh. God became flesh. Of all the languages in the world, I like the Latin languages, the Latin-based languages. Because when they refer to the Word becoming flesh, they hit all our sensitivities. Because the word base that they use is the word carn. And if you know anything about the meaning of that word, you know it basically means meat. Now think of this for a Jew, to be told this, that God becomes meat, that God is enfleshed, that there is something tangible, there is something human about God. He becomes flesh. He dwells amongst us. For a while, it isn't just another man who is here. It is God himself. And this God speaks. And he speaks with a clarity that thrills the heart of every believing person. He was, as John goes on to tell us in that first chapter, unique in that he was face to face with the Father. He is the only begotten, or if you like the NIV, he is the one and only. There is no one like him. He is utterly unique. He comes from heaven, and he brings all the wisdom of heaven with him. And he speaks. And he speaks about heaven. You know, it wasn't so very long ago when Christian people were having to defend the reality of the existence of hell. We found ourselves constantly being assaulted by people who said that they couldn't believe in hell. And one of the things that we had to remind them was this, that Jesus Christ spoke more about hell than any other person in the Bible. Now then, though we know that, we need the reminder that it is at least arguable that Jesus Christ also spoke more about heaven than any other person. So whilst we may not have the fullest picture that we would like, we certainly can have a real picture. He has left us clues. The Word who became flesh, who was face to face with the Father, who has revealed the Father to us, he has left us clues concerning the nature of heaven. Can I just say one more thing by way of introduction on this? I think it's really very important. As evangelical people, those of us that are, we have our strengths and we have our weaknesses. Well, one of our strengths is that we believe in absolute truth. We believe in truth with a capital T. We believe that there are things that we can most certainly know, and they cannot be compromised the slightest. But, you know, one of the areas of our weaknesses that we end up sometimes by slipping into giving the impression that we know everything about everything. And we then give equal prominence to all the details that we believe to be true, and we make very little distinction between those things that must surely be believed and those things that are somewhat more of a matter of contention. And we things with which we can actually live. And I have to say, concerning many of them, we have to learn to live if we are not to be regarded merely as a cult or a sect. Now then, I say that with regard to this matter of heaven, because I'm going to say some things tonight. Some of those things I'm going to say, I firmly am convinced the Bible teaches them very clearly and very boldly, and I would not compromise on them. There are some other things that I'm likely to say to you, and I will put them out as suggestions. They're deductions that I am drawing from the teaching of Scripture. And concerning some of these things, it's open to debate. So concerning some of them, if you were to collar me at the door, well, mind you, I'm pretty sure I'm going to slip out of here like grease lightning at the end. But if you manage to get me before I'm away, there will be some things that I will fight with you tooth and nail about. And there will be other things about which I will say, okay, you're entitled to your opinion. It's not mine at the moment, but it's possible that you may be right. We need to keep that kind of distinction, especially when we're thinking about the subject of heaven. All right. Negative to positives. The first negative that I want to set before you is this. We shall not be bored in heaven. Now, you know why I'm saying this. You know, given the way some people speak about heaven, some Christian people speak about heaven, I am not surprised that some non-Christian people think that it is the most terrible place that you could ever go to. Oh, they say, I would be bored out of my mind with that kind of eternal existence. And that's what you've got to keep in your mind. You've got to keep in your mind that whatever you're saying about heaven is everlasting. And sometimes we haven't really been helped by all manner of people who no doubt intended to help us. I think, for example, of some of the artistic interpretations of heaven that we have been given. Now, I'm one of these people. I like art. I like classical art, but I also like modern art. Now, that may put me beyond the pale with some of you, but I really don't mind. It's one of those areas for me which is somewhat indifferent. But you know this idea, especially in classical art, that you often get of angels or angelic-type beings, and maybe even us being angelic-type beings, seated nicely upon some huge, huge fluffy cloud and strumming away at our hearts, this is all going bad, isn't it? Strumming away at our hearts everlastingly. Now, I'm fully aware of the fact that by the time I get to heaven, I may have a different view of this, but right now I have to say to you that if someone came to me and said that's what heaven would be like, I would probably want to join the side of those who would say, well, that would bore me to tears. And look, I'm acknowledging that I might not have the same frame of mind when I get to heaven. Hopefully I won't. But the idea that that's really what heaven is about, everlastingly strumming harps sitting on fluffy clouds, no fear. I don't want that kind of boredom. It gives me no sense of excitement at all, even to imagine it. Likewise, what I would call literalistic interpretations of the Bible haven't always helped either. You know, we get the pictures. If we have allowed Jack to read on into the next portion of the book of Revelation, right up towards the end, interesting imagery is used. Streets paved with gold immediately comes to mind. All that kind of environment. And some Christian people, it doesn't seem to occur to them that sometimes the Bible does use picture language. And it doesn't intend us to take over literally things that are almost certainly difficult for us human beings properly to comprehend. So you think about heaven, and you think about it being paved with gold. If it's picture language, what is it a picture of? And the overwhelming consensus of opinion is this, that gold, the image of gold in the Bible, is used to draw attention to the glory of God and the glory of the environment that is God's. And it's that sense of glory that should be in our minds primarily, and not literalistic pavements full of gold. I wonder about the hyper-materialism of some evangelical people wanting to slip and slide upon all this gold. I don't think that has always helped us when we're thinking about heaven. Also, overly spiritual interpretations of life upon heaven, or life in heaven, have not always helped. I'm talking about this kind of impression that's given. You talk, especially to preachers and pastors, we're the worst culprits of all. And when you listen to us, and you listen to us speaking about heaven, you could be forgiven for believing that heaven was all about having a perpetual Sunday like we have now. In other words, that from morning to night through everlasting ages, we will be sitting in rows, reading our Bibles, saying our prayers, singing our hymns, and listening to never-ending sermons. Now, I've preached a few never-ending sermons, and I've never been overly impressed with myself at the end of it. The fact of the matter is, the Bible does not limit our vision to what our experience in heaven will be, to that which we know now, and including sitting in nicely arranged rows, everybody facing the front. Look, what I'm saying to you then is this. When we convey any of these images, we are almost certainly doing a disservice, not only to the teaching of the Bible, but we are also doing a disservice to these people that are listening to us speaking in this way about heaven. Because in their present state of mind, there is nothing to encourage them to want to seek it. They will be totally bored there. And the one thing that we have to get across to men and women is this. The last thing in the world that you will experience when the doors, if you'll forgive the image, the doors of heaven open before you, the last thing in the world that you can imagine is that you will enter into a realm chiefly characterized by boredom. It will be the exact opposite of all that you can imagine that is boring. Every hope, every aspiration, every desire that is good and holy, suddenly having the opportunity of being wonderfully fulfilled. Now that's more like heaven. So, we shall not be bored in heaven. The second thing that I want to suggest to you is this, and now we're getting on to the positives. We shall be at home in heaven. Every Christian will be at home in heaven. It's the house of the Lord forever. But it is our house too. It is our home too. He has brought us in, and we are glad to be at home, or at least we're glad to be in this home. You know, last year I was traveling with a couple of Polish pastors in a little car, traveling around Poland, you know, the sort of little cars where your knees are up into your chin, and your luggage is sort of squashed around you somehow, and you're traveling for miles upon miles upon miles. And a discussion began to develop amongst us about heaven, and it arose like this. As we were going along, it's a time of year when cherry trees were showing their fruit everywhere that we were going. Nice, you know, the ultimate cherry, you know, the big, fat, plump, dark cherry. You know, when you put your teeth into these cherries, you just feel the sensation of wonder. You know, it's often said, isn't it, for people who like cherries, of course, that when you've got this kind of cherry, the big problem is you buy some and you hardly can stop eating until they've all gone. Well, I had this sort of relationship with cherries for a little while during the course of the year, and I could see all my temptations emerging as we were going there, and I said, wow, this is the time of cherries, isn't it? Will we be able to stop and get some somewhere? Oh, the house to which we are going. The garden is full of cherry trees. My immediate response, it was just a sort of a dose of enthusiasm really, was, ah, heaven. And then this, of course, prompted the question, a quite understandable question. Do you think there'll be cherry trees in heaven? I wonder how you would respond to that. I think one of the things that we have to do when we're thinking about heaven is this, of not merely thinking about dying and separation of body and soul. We have to transpose ourselves in our mind to the picture that is given towards the end of Revelation, when it speaks about the introduction of a new heaven and a new earth. And to do that changes your whole perspective of this other thing that is more like floating around in ether that we imagine. When the new heaven and the new earth dawns, this will be our happy environment. And it leads me to this conclusion. It's at least a tentative conclusion. It seems to me that from everything that God has revealed of the way that he does things upon this earth, it at least seems reasonable to suppose that there will always be continuity and discontinuity. There will always be a connection between that ultimate state of the new heaven and the new earth. There will be continuity, there will be a connection, a similarity, a familiarity with that which becomes and that which is. Look, we were mentioning this morning about dying and what happens to to our bodies, that it becomes dust. The important thing to remember about that is it doesn't become nothing. There's always something in God's creation, whatever he makes that is good. I'm not talking about the corruption that subsequently sets in, but everything that he makes is made to last, and it never entirely disappears. And I think that we have the right to that expectation concerning the new heaven and the new earth. In other words, when we get there, some things will be different, but some things will be familiar. Or maybe to put it like this, and this is just a guess, but when the new heaven dawns and you and I see the wonder of it, our first response will be something like, although our command of the English language or whatever language is going to be, I know the Welsh have their view on this, but the language that we are likely to use will resemble something like, wow. But it will be followed up by this, a sense that I am at home, a sense that I know this, this is familiar to me, and yet I never thought it would be so good. It's the continuity and discontinuity, it's the familiar and the unfamiliar. The unfamiliar is the wow factor, but the familiar, we will be living upon a new earth. So I want to summarize here what I need to say in these two ways. First of all, we shall have a familiar, though marvelously new environment. After all, the ultimate to which we aspire is not death, separation of body and soul, but to be in the new heaven and the new earth. No less a person than Jesus Christ once referred to heaven by the term paradise. And I think that when he did so, he was not only thinking about that which is ultimate, but he was making a connection with what was before, the Garden of Eden. And therefore, rightly or wrongly, I have come to this tentative conclusion. Perhaps when we are thinking about the ultimate that awaits the children of God in heaven or about heaven, we should be thinking more in terms of a better Eden than anything else. Maybe John Milton, when he wrote not only Paradise Lost but Paradise Regained, wasn't so far away from the mark when he referred to Paradise Regained. Or to put it in another term, some of you will remember reading at some time in your life Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11 is a most beautiful, beautiful poetic expression of truth. And it describes the new heaven, the new earth. I can remember as a young Christian when I first read this, going to an older and wiser person and saying, what does he mean when he says that the lion will lay down with the lamb? You know, the last thing in the world that you can imagine right now is the lion laying down with the lamb. And I've never forgotten his reply. He said, this is a great picture of the ultimate peace that the whole creation will know. Peace. The emphasis is all upon peace. And I'm sure he was right. But the trouble about just speaking in terms of peace is that we can actually be suggesting that there will not be any real lion and there will not be any real lamb. And I have to say, I am not convinced of this. Simply on the basis of this whole idea of continuity and discontinuity, the familiar and the unfamiliar, the lamb really lying down with the lion, put it deliberately the other way around. It is a picture that may have more truth in it than we have led to believe. No, I'm not suggesting that your pet poodle or whatever it is going to be there, but why not all the animal creation being represented in some particular way for us? And I'm not just reproducing Plato here, but some reality of all that God has made, simply because nothing is finally to be extinguished. I'll leave you time to think about that. But I am suggesting this. Maybe there will be cherry trees in heaven. And if you don't like cherries, well, I hope you do when you finally get there. And if you see a man sitting under a cherry tree on the new earth reading a book, that's most likely going to be me. I certainly hope that there will be cherry trees in heaven. But the main point that I'm trying to make is this. There will be that which is familiar, and there will be that which is new about our environment. We shall also have a familiar, though gloriously new body. We're not to be disembodied spirits. I think the Bible is very, very clear about that. We are not complete until we are enfleshed again. We will take on a new body out of that which goes to the earth. Something new, don't ask me how, but something new will be created that will be both familiar to us, and yet the wow factor will come in again. I don't know exactly what it will be like. I don't know precisely how it will function, but the very fact of having a body again certainly suggests this. Service. That there will be an opportunity for service on the new earth. But with this difference. No fatigue. No frustration. No disease. No pain. No death. I even wonder. I'm allowed to wonder. Human beings are allowed to wonder. They have to make a distinction between that which they can say dogmatically and that which they can wonder about. I even wonder if there might be a new mandate for the new creation. Remember Genesis chapter 1 verses 26 to 28. It's often referred to as the creation mandate. Maybe on that new earth there will be a new mandate for us. The whole universe before us, to know, to explore, and to do so in such a way as to honour and to glorify God. Look, I can't be certain, but I'm allowed to wonder. So, I'm suggesting to you that we will not be bored in heaven, and I'm also suggesting to you that we will be at home in heaven. And the third and the most important thing of all is this. We shall be with Christ in heaven. And this is the most important thing of all about heaven. Go back to John chapter 14, the opening verses. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions or many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Remember this morning we mentioned in passing a statement in the letter of Paul to the Philippians, where he says that to die is gain, that it's better by far. What is it that makes it better by far? But the Lord is there. Christ is there in all his glory, in all his majesty, in the awesomeness of his power. And we shall be with him. Even when Paul is contemplating what we often refer to as the intermediate state, not the new earth, but not now, he speaks about that place, that situation where we are absent from the body, and he says, even then we're present with the Lord. But there is something more to come. Present with the body and present with the Lord. And that has tremendous implications for us. It will mean, first of all, seeing Christ. This morning I mentioned in passing Job chapter 14. Job with all those troubles and difficulties, crying out at one stage, if a man dies, shall he live again? When you turn to Job chapter 19, you read these wonderful words from verse 25 onwards. Job says, look, in the midst of his pain, in the midst of his agony, the kind of agony that most of us have hardly a clue about at all, and he says, for I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth. And after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold and not another. And then he says this, how my heart yearns within me. He's got that sight of heaven. He's got that sight of his Redeemer, the one who is the great focal point of heaven. And he says, when I see this, all my other cares and concerns are all secondary. I yearn, I long for this. Paul says, now we know in part, then we shall see face to face. We shall see him. And when we see him, we shall be overwhelmed with love. To see him who loves us will bring in the sight of the glory that we've longed for, and our hearts will be overwhelmed with love for him. In the first letter of Peter, chapter 1, it speaks about this great, great love that we shall know in seeing him whom our hearts have longed for. It will mean seeing him. It will also mean being like Christ. Think about that for a moment. No more sin. It got into that first Eden. It will not get into this second one. No more sin. Perfect righteousness. The righteousness of Christ, wonderfully, fully, completely reproduced in us. You know, when a Christian sometimes, in the midst of their difficulties and their sinfulness, they cry out in a sort of, maybe an internal crying out, but in the depths of their being, they're asking themselves, how can I ever face God? And the answer is here. Christ will be all that we have ever needed. Perfect righteousness is ours in him. Look, my friends, what an incentive this is to live for Christ now. Not just to think about living for heaven, though that's wonderful, but to live for Christ now. There's yet to come a day for every believer when you and I will perfectly reflect the righteousness Christ. And you know, when you get to heaven, if you get there, when you get there, one of the first realizations that you and I will know is this: that knowing him and seeing him and being like him is so much better than I have ever been told before or could ever imagine. Heaven. We may not know all that there is to know, we certainly don't. We may not even know as much as we long to know, but this much we do know: when we see him, we shall be like him, and we shall be glad. So then, finally and very quickly, how will anyone get to heaven? There is often confusion about this too. It's probably the most confusing thing that goes on in people's minds and hearts. Let me just say two things about this quickly. We will not get to heaven as a consequence of anything that we are or have done. That's the biggest mistake of the human race. It was a mistake from the beginnings of the fallen world that we have inherited. It remains the biggest mistake that men and women, when thinking about religion, make to this very day. The belief that somehow, because I am who I am, or I have done what I have done, then heaven is assured. We need to get this etched into our minds. I am not good enough for heaven. I am not good enough to face God. There is not one human being that you and I know that is good enough for heaven. What's the problem? Well, my sin is the problem. My sin has bolted the door of heaven against me. And the bolt is on the inside of the door. How is heaven gained then? Heaven is only gained through trusting in the merits of Jesus Christ. Why did he come into the world? He came into the world to pay the price for our sins and to transfer to believing hearts all the benefits of his righteous character. He came, he lived, he died, that the door of heaven might be opened for us. Or to put it in the words of the hymn that we sang earlier on. Were you a little confused about that hymn slipping in there? There is a green hill far away. We're all singing about heaven all day long, and suddenly we're back at the cross again. Well, because the writer tells us very powerfully, he only could unlock the gates of heaven and let us in. In other words, how do we get to heaven? Jesus Christ alone can take us there. He alone. I am the way, he said. I am the truth, he said. I am the life, he said. No one comes to the Father except through me. Look, Jesus Christ does not seem to have been troubled about saying things that we find difficult to believe. And every time that someone raised a word of opposition to these great claims that he made, he simply reinforced the claims. No one comes to the Father, he says, except by me. Do you want to go to heaven? Then you must seek heaven by and through and in Jesus Christ. He is the only hope for sinners on the outside of heaven that they might ever get in. What is heaven like? How do we get there? There's a sense in which how we get there is actually more important than we can actually know about what heaven will be like if and when we get there. Christ is your doorway to God and peace with him everlastingly.